From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sheldon Harnick wrote the lyrics for one of the biggest hits in Broadway history, Fiddler on the Roof. One of his favorite shows is his lesser-known musical, She Loves Me, which closed after only 300 performances. Now it's being revived on Broadway. On the special holiday archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature a 1988 interview with Sheldon Harnick. Also today from our archives, an interview with filmmaker Kenneth Branagh. He directed and stars in the new film Much Ado About Nothing. He'll tell us about the vocal training that's helped him do Shakespearean soliloquies and play a wisecracking American detective. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new recordings by alto saxophonist Lee Konitz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton spoke at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall today. The president received a mixed welcome. Some veterans said Mr. Clinton's visit to the wall was insulting because he protested the Vietnam War as a college student. In his speech, the president recognized the anger, but he called for unity in memory of the veterans whose names make up the memorial wall.
No one has come here today to disagree about the heroism of those whom we honor. But the only way we can really honor their memory is to resolve to live and serve today and tomorrow as best we can, and to make America the best that she can be. Surely that is what we owe to all those whose names are etched in this beautiful memorial.
The president also promised that the government will declassify nearly all the documents relating to prisoners of war and service people missing in action. He said the United States will continue to press Vietnam for cooperation on the issue. A delegation of American politicians and war veterans has arrived in Hanoi in an attempt to get unrestricted access to records from the Vietnam War. Cooperation by the Vietnamese government could lead to a lifting of economic sanctions in place since the war. Humphrey Hawksley reports.
This is one of the highest profile American delegations to go to Vietnam, and its objective is to end the sensitive dispute over servicemen missing in action. Its leader is Senator John Kerry, a decorated Vietnam War veteran who said on arrival in Hanoi that he wanted to get answers and push the process. Within hours, the delegation had been given some documents by Vietnamese officials. But the powerful lobby representing MIA families wants President Clinton to continue sanctions against Vietnam. They say if he gives in, they may never find out what happened to the servicemen or if any are still alive. But Mr. Clinton is under pressure from businessmen to lift the embargo so they can operate in Vietnam, seen as one of the big untapped opportunities of Asia's economic boom.
Humphrey Hawksley reporting for the BBC. A top Russian diplomat is reported to be working on a new initiative for peace talks on the war in Bosnia. The Interfax news agency reported that Deputy Foreign Minister Vitaly Churkin said that the initiative is being coordinated with other countries, but refused to give details. The news agency said the plan would consist of a series of international talks aimed at implementing the UN-backed peace plan. UN officials said today that three Italian aid workers in Bosnia were shot and killed today by gunmen wearing Muslim uniforms. The aid workers were part of a five-man humanitarian team that was stopped by robbers on a road about 30 miles west of Sarajevo. This is NPR. Weather forecasters in Florida say that parts of the state could get almost a foot of rain as the season's first tropical depression moves north from the Caribbean. The 1993 Atlantic hurricane season doesn't officially begin until tomorrow. Weather experts say the current low-pressure system formed near Cuba and was expected to move slowly northward through the day. They said the system will be named Arlene if its winds build up enough to qualify it as a tropical storm. That requires sustained winds of at least 39 miles an hour. Experts say the winds aren't expected to increase much. Former French actress Brigitte Bardot, who's now an animal rights campaigner, has angered Muslims in France by criticizing their slaughter of sheep today, which is a Muslim holiday. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Brigitte Bardot said she was revolted and outraged by the slaughter of sheep, which she called a barbaric custom from the Dark Ages. She also said the Catholic Feast of Pentecost, which is also celebrated today, had been overshadowed by the Muslim religion, which had taken over France. There are about 3 million Muslims in France, and they celebrated their holiday by killing 10,000 sheep under official supervision. A Muslim spokesman in Nice reacted to Bordeaux by saying her comment was political. He added, "Why doesn't she react when villages are burned in the former Yugoslavia or when Muslims have their throats cut in Kashmir?" Bordeaux denied that her comments were linked to the fact that she just married a man with extreme right-wing links. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
A new survey suggests that the job market isn't likely to improve much in the third quarter of the year, but that hiring may finally begin to pick up in the final 3 months. The quarterly survey was conducted by Manpower, the nation's biggest temporary help agency. The report says that 25% of the companies interviewed plan to add permanent jobs in the third quarter. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sheldon Harnick wrote the lyrics for the musicals Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, She Loves Me, Tenderloin, and The Apple Tree. One of his favorites, She Loves Me, is being revived on Broadway. It opens June 10th. So we've gone back into the archives to bring you our 1988 interview with Harnick. He co-wrote most of his best-known songs with composer Jerry Bock. Their collaboration ended in 1970 after their musical The Rothschilds. She Loves Me first opened on Broadway in April of 1963 and closed 8.5 months later. Here's the title song from the original cast recording.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it, knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true, she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah! Now today she likes me, ha! And tomorrow, tomorrow, ah! My teeth ache from the urge to touch her. I'm speechless, for I mustn't tell her. It's wrong now, but it won't be long now before my love discovers that she and I are lovers. Imagine how surprised she's bound to be. She loves me. She loves me. I love her. Isn't that a wonder?
Sheldon Harnick told me that When She Loves Me opened in 1963, it seemed to have a very limited audience. It was perhaps too literate and too gentle.
As a matter of fact, when it closed, I was quite distressed because I loved the show so. And for about 2 years, if I remember correctly, it seemed to be dead, which was both bewildering and depressing. But through the years, it got performances, and I began to get letters. Jerry Bock and I both got letters from companies who performed it saying, we love the show, we love to perform it, and that was gratifying. And over the years, little by little, it's made its way into the mainstream of shows that get performed.
Let me ask you a couple of things about the title song that we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
The initial rhymes are really repetitions. She loves me, but she doesn't know it. No, she loves me, but she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it?
Mm-hmm.
What goes through your mind when you're using, say, two its instead of rhyming an it with a sit or an it with a bit, but to reuse that word?
Oh, that's a different kind of rhyme. The rhyme is not it. If you'll notice, the accent is on the first, is on the prior syllable. Show it, know it, and that's done all the time. If it were one word, it would be like action, faction.
Mm-hmm.
So that the rhyme is not necessarily on the last syllable. It's where the stress is. And in those cases, the stress is on show and on know.
I like the line, my teeth ache from the urge to touch her.
Well, that's an extremely personal line. I was trying to use myself as George, and I realized that there are situations with some women where whatever the feelings are, they get me right in the back of the teeth. Now, I had a friend who, not having had that experience, he said, what kind of a line is that? He said, I love you, and my foot hurts, you know. So it was very personal to me, and I just hoped that other people either would identify with it or at least understand what I was saying.
I want to play the opening number. that you wrote the lyrics for She Loves Me. This is called Good Morning, Good Day. But before we hear it, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the function that this song had to serve within the play, because opening numbers are really important. They have to set the tone for everything that's going to follow, and they frequently have to introduce the characters as well.
Right.
What are some of the functions this song had to play when you were writing it?
Well, I guess the main thing that the song did was to set the tone of the show. And for good or for bad, it's a gentle tone. It's not a razzle-dazzle opening number. Also, the number lyrics and music interweave with some of Joe Mastaroff's dialogue. So it was really a delineation of character at the top of the show, the people we were going to be spending the next 2 hours with. And mostly it was that. It was getting you to know them, getting you to get a sense of the fact that they're comrades in this shop that they all work in.
Okay, let's hear a part of Good Morning, Good Day with the lyrics by my guest Sheldon Harnick.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this beautiful day? Isn't this a beautiful morning?
Very.
Hey, seat boss, how's this?
That's a very elegant pose, but is all that elegance necessary?
And why not? I represent Marichex, don't I? We're not a butcher shop or a hardware store. We're a perfumery, and that means we're
stylish.
That's it.
With a quiet dignity.
Yes, and we get the tilt of our hats right.
That's right.
When I ride my bike, people see what Marichek's like. So I think it's very important that I look my best. Here comes Miss Ritter.
Miss Ritter.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this glorious day? Have you seen a lovelier morning?
Never.
It's too nice a day to be inside shuffling soap. I have no more energy whatsoever. Does anybody mind if I take the day off? Arpad, why aren't you old enough to take me away from all this?
I'm old enough.
Then marry me and I'll put my...
You know, listening to that, it's easy for me to understand why you're doing operettas now and one-act operas. I seem to hear a connection between some of the writing that you did for She Loves Me.
Right. I'm sure I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I think I was leaning towards that kind of through-composed style where it would be either sung all the way through or a mix of music and dialogue that totaled up to almost a complete musical experience.
When you're writing a lyric, do you find that you frequently throw out the first few versions of it before you come up with the one you like, or are you lucky enough to hit on it the first time?
Well, what I find, funny you should say that, I haven't thought about this for a while, but what I find is quite often the first version of a lyric, it's not that the lyric won't be technically good, and the idea may even be good, but what I find is I don't know the character well enough yet, so that as my acquaintance with the character deepens, then I will look at that lyric and no longer be satisfied with it and think, no, that's really not what the character would say at this time, so that I throw it out and start over again. And if I'm lucky, I'm able to salvage some of the better lines from the song.
Do you allow yourself to use the same rhyme twice in different songs?
I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean.
Say you used a rhyme 15 years ago in a song.
Oh.
And those particular words will work just fine in a song you're working on now. Will you rule it out because you already used it once?
If it's a trick rhyme, yeah, I'll rule it out. I try and avoid that. Sometimes, of course, you don't remember. What's more difficult, I once asked Ogden Nash, a man I loved, and I loved his work. I was his assistant for a television show years ago called Art Carney Meets Peter and the Wolf, so I got to meet him and work with him. And I said, what happened? Well, how do you feel if you write a rhyme that you feel is original with you, and then you hear another song, an earlier song, where that rhyme has been used? Do you have to go back and rewrite? And Ogden started laughing. He said, oh my, he said, I write rhymes and I'm so proud of myself. I think they're fresh and new. And then I find out that Larry Hart wrote them 20 years ago. And he said, all I can tell you is if you feel that you've created that rhyme, then use it. He said, there's no reason to change it just because someone else has. And as a matter of fact, I've started reading poetry late in my life, in the last 8 years or so, I've been going through poetry. And I find with Browning and with Lowell and people like that, they've used all of those complicated rhymes a century before we did.
And that doesn't bother you, though?
No.
What are you learning from reading poetry that applies to songs?
I think what I'm learning is that the great poets, not even the great poets, the minor poets, all good poets, have a genuine care for using the right word in the right place. I think that comes through, and it makes you want to, it inspires you to do the same, to be careful, to write with as great care as possible so that you really express what it is that you yourself are feeling.
You never write pop songs, at least not that I know of. All of your songs are written in the context of a show.
Right. I learned very early that that was not my talent. I was quite disappointed when I discovered that, because when I came to New York from Chicago, it was with the idea of being another Irving Berlin, writing for the theater and having songs come out of it that were pop hits. And little by little, as I talked to people and as I looked around and as I was honest with myself, I thought, no, that's not the way I write. So I was hoping that ultimately some of the songs from the shows would become standards, and that's what happened. There's been a few.
Well, what did make you realize that your gift was for writing songs within shows and not just pop songs?
Well, I think one of the... There were two experiences, I think. One, I hadn't been in New York too long when I had four songs in an off-Broadway review called the Shoestring Review, and they got very nice press. So I was invited up to meet a publisher in the pop field, and I played him my stuff. And after I did, they said, well, your work is too filled with ideas. It's not simple enough for what we want is something much simpler. And I thought, I guess that's true, but I write complicated most of the time, or at least I do try and put ideas in. I thought, well, if that's the case, that's the case. Then the other experience was, after I had met Jerry Bock and we started to work together, there was a period when we didn't particularly have a show to work on, so we worked on a lot of what were meant to be pop songs. And we didn't sell any of them. And at a certain point, we looked at each other and thought, well, that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm. Before you started working with composer Jerry Bock, you were writing music for your own songs. And I think it was Yip Harburg, the lyricist who's probably best known for writing lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, who told you to stick to lyrics. Was that good advice?
Yes. Well, it certainly facilitated my career. What he did was to tell me that, in his estimation at that time, this was the early 50s, that there were more capable theater composers than there were capable theater lyricists. So what he actually said was, if you can facilitate your career by agreeing to collaborate with other composers instead of writing music yourself. And that's what I did. Shortly before he died, as a matter of fact, he told a good friend of mine, Madeline Guilford, who was a very close friend of his, my name came up in a conversation they were having, and Yip said, I wonder if I did that young man a disservice. He said his music was fine, but I wanted him to get ahead faster, so I wanted him to work with other people, and I hope I didn't steer him away from writing his own music.
I think one of the things that would be really nice about writing lyrics to somebody else's music is that you've got a variety of lines to write to. That you've got, if the music's coming first, you have somebody else's lines to fit your words and rhymes to, and that there'd be less of a possibility of getting stuck or of rewriting the same song.
Well, there's always the possibility of getting stuck, but what is wonderful about writing with someone else, there's two things that come to mind. One is that music, although people consider it as an abstract art form, music to me is very concrete. Music says certain things, so that when I hear a piece of music, when Jerry used to give me a tape with a lot of new music on it, music suggests ideas, music suggests emotions and moods, and I would find myself getting ideas for lyrics that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't heard those pieces of music. So that was wonderful. The other thing is, as you were implying, one of the difficult things to create in writing a lyric is the form of the lyric, or at least it's difficult for me. Maybe other people don't have that problem. But to create a fresh form is not always easy. And when someone gives you a piece of music, the form is there. So you don't have to worry about that. All you have to worry about is the other things, singability and clarity and rhyme and things like that.
Stephen Sondheim, back at his lecture on lyrics that he gave at the New York Y years ago, this was in the 1970s, said that you were one of his favorite lyricists and that he liked your work for its grace, its charm, and its perfection of setting. And I think that perfection of setting has really been an important one for you when I think of the different kinds of settings you've had to write for. Fiorello, which is about New York politics. Fiddler on the Roof, which is set in an Eastern European shtetl. I mean, those are two really different extremes that you had to write lyrics for.
Mm-hmm. I do my research, and as a matter of fact, I think that accounts for the least successful show that I did.
Which one?
The first one with Jerry Bock was called The Body Beautiful. And I accepted the show because I was very hungry to get a show on Broadway, but it was not the show I should have done. It was about boxing. And boxing was a sport and a milieu that I really had almost no interest in. So although I did my research, my heart wasn't in it.
Well, Fiddler on the Roof, which was a very unusual setting, the Eastern European shtetl, was one of your most successful shows, one of the most successful shows on Broadway, probably. This was one of the shows that you initiated the idea for.
Right. A friend had sent me a novel by Sholem Aleichem, a book called Wandering Star, about a Yiddish theatrical troupe touring all over Russia and Poland. And I loved it. I gave it to Jerry Bock to read. He loved it. And we gave it to Joe Stein to read. Joe read it, and he said, it's too sprawling. It covers 40 years. It has a cast. I mean, it has about 80 characters. It's just too big. He said, but the writing is wonderful, and it's very inherently musical. Why don't we look for more things by Sholem Aleichem? So we did, and we found the Tevye stories, which we then optioned and began the project ourselves.
We're listening to a 1988 interview with lyricist Sheldon Harnick. His musical She Loves Me is being revived on Broadway. It opens June 10th. Back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Lyricist Sheldon Harnick is my guest. We were talking before about songs that do and don't have lives outside of the show, and you said you always wanted to write songs that would have a life outside of the show. I think the songs in Fiddler on the Roof certainly did, and I think especially of Sunrise Sunset, about how many weddings that
right.
song has been sung at. Have you been to weddings where they sang that song?
I've not only been to weddings where they've sung that song, but I have a number of friends who've asked me and my wife to sing that song. For instance, Alan Alda's daughter got married, and one of his daughters got married, and Margie and I sang there. So we've sung the song ourselves at a number of weddings.
Can I ask you to recite the lyrics from the song?
Or the opening. I think I can remember the first chorus anyway.
Okay.
Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play? I don't remember growing older. When did they? When did she get to be a beauty? When did he grow to be so tall? Wasn't it yesterday that they were small? Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the days. Seedlings turn overnight to sunflowers, blossoming even as we gaze. Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and tears.
What came first in that song when you were writing it?
The music. And I remember it very vividly. Jerry Bock was living in New Rochelle at the time, and I would take the train out there. We would go into his basement where he had a studio. And he played me the music for Sunrise Sunset. And I was so moved by it. I had the experience of having, I've used this phrase describing this experience before, I had the experience of having lyrics kind of crystallize on the notes. It came out very fast, very rapidly, and we were both so thrilled with it that we called Jerry's wife, Patty. We said, come down, come down. She ran down to the basement, and we played it, and she wept.
That was a good sign, huh?
Yes.
Did you learn about writing songs in settings by some of the early work that you did for industries. You wrote a lot of industrial shows, I think, for places like Esso and Nabisco, Buick. What did you write songs for them?
They had an interesting policy. They used standard music, and what my job was to take the material they did, the points they wanted to make. Most of the shows I did were for salesmen, either introducing a new product or a new slogan or just making them more enthusiastic about what they were doing, so that my job was fitting this material into existing music. They felt that it was enough to give their audiences the message without asking them to absorb new melodies as well. And as a matter of fact, later they got sued for this because I didn't know at the time that they hadn't been they hadn't been paying the composers. As a matter of fact, I did a long lyric to the Meredith Willson's song Trouble, and somebody who was in the industrial show that we did was a friend of Meredith Willson's, and he called Meredith Willson not to complain, but just to say what fun it was doing this new lyric to Meredith Willson's tune. And Wilson, of course, was shocked. He said, "What do you mean? Nobody asked me for my permission." But what that experience did for me was to refine my craft, because especially for an industrial show, everything had to be done with the greatest possible clarity, the greatest possible economy, and the greatest possible effectiveness. So it was learning to hone my skills.
Do you remember any of the lyrics you wrote for those industrials?
Oh, no, that was...
too long ago. Huh?
That's too long ago. That's about 30 years ago.
When you're looking at a book that you're going to be writing the lyrics for, how do you know where the songs go? What makes the place in a Broadway book for a song?
Well, there can be a number of different places. One, of course, which we're all taught, is that one looks for the emotional high point of the scene, where the emotion is so strong that the words want to start soaring. Instead of just being spoken, you want the addition of music to deepen the emotion. But also, there can be a spot, for instance, in Fiorello, as Jerome Wideman wrote the book, he had a scene in a political clubhouse where the men were playing poker. And I thought, oh my, I played a lot of poker in the Army, and I remembered a lot of the colorful lingo that went with poker, and I thought, I want to use that lingo for a colorful lyric. So I spoke to Jerome Wideman, and I said, I want to borrow some of your lines, and I want to change a large part of this poker game into music. And he said, be my guest. He was very generous, so I did that.
You remember any of the lyric?
Oh,
this is politics and poker.
This is politics
about, right?
And politics and poker. Well, the first part was all that King Betts. I panic whenever anybody asks me to remember one of my lyrics. But it's
feel like an imposter when that happens.
They'll see right through me. They'll see that I have this small boy who comes in and does all my lyrics for me.
Well, one last question. When you're writing lyrics for a song, where are you? At the piano, at the desk, on the couch, driving in the car?
I'm various places. Where I prefer to be when I start is in a reclining chair. And on a little end table next to the chair is my thesaurus and my rhyming dictionary if I need them. But I like to be quiet and calm and just in a position to think and hoping that the phone won't ring because I'm a compulsive answerer. Then, once the lyric is started and it reaches a point where I'm excited about what I'm doing, then it can be on a subway, on a train, walking around the city. In fact, I have to be careful that I don't walk right out into traffic.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick, recorded in 1988. His musical She Loves Me is being revived on Broadway. It opens June 10th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Kenneth Branagh about how he talks. Branagh is now starring in the film Much Ado About Nothing. He also made an acclaimed film of Henry V. In between these two adaptations of Shakespeare, he played a wisecracking detective from Los Angeles. Also today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new recordings by alto saxophonist Lee Konitz. Kevin considers Konitz one of the greatest living jazz musicians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Facing shouting Vietnam veterans calling him a coward, President Clinton delivered his Memorial Day address in front of the Vietnam War Memorial. Mr. Clinton, who protested against the Vietnam War and took steps to avoid serving, asked the veterans to put their complaints aside. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
For many veterans, having Bill Clinton come to the memorial was a slap in the face. Posters declared Clinton a draft dodger and a liar, and shouts from the crowd echoed those sentiments. But many others who came to honor those that died in Southeast Asia saw President Clinton's speech as courageous, a healing process. For the president, today's speech was part of a vigorous effort to improve his image with the military.
Let us continue to disagree, if we must, about the war, but let us not let it divide us as a people any longer.
Despite the heckling during his speech, the president made one announcement that pleased everyone at the ceremony. He said he had ordered that all U.S. military records pertaining to missing Americans be made public by Veterans Day. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Diplomats have ended their fact-finding mission to Guatemala amid growing pressure on the country's president, Jorge Serrano, to resign. NPR's Tom Gibb reports from Guatemala City on the mission headed by the Secretary General of the Organization of American States.
The OAS Secretary General, João Baena Suárez, said he'd be presenting a full report of the situation in Guatemala to a meeting of the continent's foreign ministers in Washington on Thursday. Before leaving the country, he held a last-minute meeting with President Serrano, who suspended the Constitution and dissolved the Congress and Supreme Court last week. In the street outside, leading politicians, the authors of Guatemala's 1985 constitution, shouted for President Serrano to resign. Almost everyone, from right-wing businessmen to left-wing unions, now want him to go. The army has dropped its unconditional support, urging a return to institutional rule as soon as possible, and the newspapers and radios are openly defying government censorship. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in Guatemala City.
Khmer Rouge guerrillas ambushed a UN convoy in eastern Cambodia. One Uruguayan peacekeeper was killed and five wounded. Today's attack was the second attack following largely peaceful elections imposed by the Khmer Rouge. Earlier, guerrillas fired at French troops. The guerrillas had vowed to disrupt the balloting, but generally let it proceed. An opposition party that had endorsed reconciliation with the Khmer Rouge is winning by a small margin in unofficial results. That party is allied with head of state Prince Sihanouk, who has rescinded his promise to include the Khmer Rouge in a future government. This is NPR News. Three Italian aid workers have been killed in Bosnia in the first reported deliberate killing of foreigners who were not taking part in the civil war. UN officials say the aid workers were robbed and shot point blank by gunmen in uniform. The officials say the gunmen had cap badges used by some Muslim militias, but the Muslim-led Bosnian army has denied any connection to them. The officials say the killings were reported after Bosnian army troops found two survivors of the shootings. The survivors were found near Gornjiva Kuf, about 30 miles west of Sarajevo. UN officials in Bosnia say the fighting in and around the capital, Sarajevo, is making it difficult to set up safe havens in the republic. Meanwhile, Bosnia's deputy president, Ejup Ganić, says the international community's attitude toward Bosnia amounts to genocide. Jeremy Bowen reports from Sarajevo.
Dr. Ganić was angry and pessimistic after the violence in and around Sarajevo on Sunday. he said an injustice had been done to his country by the international community. Its strategy, he said, ended up helping the Bosnian Serbs. Dr. Ganic said the safe areas in Djepa and Srebrenica were a case in point. The deployment of UN troops in those towns, he said, had freed up to 10,000 Serb soldiers for the attack on Garajde, which he said was still going on. The UN was such a harmful force here, he said, that it might as well go. The Bosnian government is reacting now with real anger to what it sees as the indifference of the outside world. The army commander, General Sefa Halilovic, told the BBC today that the international community wouldn't be allowed to put Bosnians in reservations. He said they would go on fighting for their freedom.
The BBC's Jeremy Bowen. The national parliament of what remains of Yugoslavia voted today to remove the national president. Dobrica Kosic was once a close ally of Serbian President Milosevic, but now is seen as too moderate by radical Serbs. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Kenneth Branagh first came to our attention with his acclaimed screen adaptation of Shakespeare's Henry V, which he directed and starred in. Now Branagh is back in American movie theaters, starring in a new Shakespeare adaptation, which he also directed, the romantic comedy Much Ado About Nothing. Branagh isn't interested only in the classics. In between these two films, he directed and starred in Dead Again, playing a wisecracking Los Angeles detective. Our interview was recorded in 1991, after the release of Dead Again. Branagh told me how he learned to speak like an American for his role as a detective in Dead Again.
Well, I think a key thing was not to was to pay attention to the smaller words, like what, you know. Instead of saying what, you'd say what, and lots of little abbreviated things like that. Not to gesture too much. I mean, I really did start very kind of, you know, overblown and kind of nasal and mad and completely non-understandable. And I literally had to travel my accent across the country. It was like getting on the accent train. And it went pretty much via Alabama and all sorts of places until it really took time living in Los Angeles to hear. What we were trying to go for was a sort of neutral West Coast sound, which I think people fairly rightly think does not really constitute a distinctive accent in the same way as a Southern accent or a you know, Brooklyn accent. But in a sense, it makes it somehow more difficult to do because there are definite sounds, but they're subtle.
I think accent has always been crucial for you, having grown up in Belfast. You had an accent when you started acting that would have been considered, I think, unacceptable for a classical actor in England.
Yeah, I mean, the Belfast accent is a very hard one. You know, that is quite, when people speak very quickly, it's very hard to understand because it's very nasal and very got very sharp edges. But it's one that I mean, I left Belfast when I was 9, so although there were very formative years there, and indeed one feels very Irish, I moved to a part of England that was so suburban and wonderfully bland, actually, that it that after a while it produces the blanded, rounded tones you hear before you.
You write in your memoir that when you got to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England, that everybody around you sounded like they spoke on the BBC every day, and you felt like you were talking really differently, and you were very self-conscious.
Yeah, it's a very sort of fundamental thing, I think, one's identity as partly defined by the way one sounds, and of course, Britain still remains riddled by the notion of class, and as manifested in all sorts of conflicts between people from the provinces and people from the city and people from different income groups, one means of telling all that is the way people speak. So it's for everybody in England, I think it's an ongoing. One's very aware of it, and I guess in a sense it was very helpful to become an actor because you are encouraged to produce a sort of neutral sound, a neutral accent, if you like, that helps you get work, because basically potential employers have so little imagination that if you walk in with a strong regional accent and you're perhaps auditioning for a part that requires, say, BBC English, They, on the whole, don't believe you can do it. If you walk in with a neutral accent and you're perhaps auditioning for a part with a regional accent, they tend to believe you can. And so the harsh employment realities of that meant that we all had to change a bit, and all the more sort of tight-assed newsreader types had to calm it down a bit, and those of us with slightly more regional brogues had to even them up a bit. But eventually, you know, as an actor, I think it's quite useful to have a sort of rather anonymous voice in a way, so that, I mean, as for instance in Dead Again, one can then have great fun sounding completely different.
We're featuring a 1991 interview with Kenneth Branagh. He's now starring in a film adaptation of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, which he also directed. Back after this break, this is Fresh Air. Kenneth Branagh is my guest.
Now, you wrote in your memoir that voice teachers were particularly hard on you. Why? Yeah.
Well, what happens when you, or at least what happened when I started at drama school, was there's a process of, I suppose you could loosely call it, breaking down in order to sort of build you up again. That is to say that they make you aware of every habitual physical misuse that you may indulge in. So if you have very bad posture, if you have stooped shoulders, if you have, as I had and have, a rather stiff jaw, if you're, the arch in your back throws your stomach out and you don't rest your weight evenly on your feet, and if you have a lisp or you have funny teeth or you have anything that does not allow you to produce what was a favourite phrase of my voice teachers, which was rich, dark, golden brown sound. And if you couldn't produce rich, dark, golden brown sound, they let you know that you had a stiff jaw, that your tongue was too short, that you had dark L's, whatever they are, and that you were more or less a physical wreck. And over the course of 7 terms, I think the idea was to allow you to analyse those things, to be in control of them, to be in control of your short tongue, your dark L's, make them light L's, perhaps, and improve your posture, do Alexander technique and all things connected to being a perfect physical specimen. So it was sometimes a painful process, but it was it did indeed do just that. It made you aware of all the things that are very imperfect bodies sometimes prevent us from doing if we're trying to be amazing acting machines.
So in what way, though, were your voice teachers particularly hard on you?
Well, they said I had a very stiff jaw, and that I projected from the throat rather than from the ribs and the diaphragm, and that I also had a rolling gait. I had, because my jaw was stiff and my neck was also stiff, they described it as when I started acting, you know, everything tensed up, you know. So they spent a long time trying to sort of relax me and allow the sound to come from further down in one's body. So you've got more resonance as the sound comes up from your tummy and, you know, resonates in your ribs rather than starting in your throat and only having your mouth to resonate in. It's a much thinner sound. And it was all very technical and everything, but very, in the end, very interesting. And, you know, we used to do inane exercises, sitting around with our hands on our knees, all facing each other, doing whether the weather be hot or whether the weather be fine, or whether the weather be cold or whether the weather be ooja flip. Whatever the weather, will weather the weather, whether we like it or not. And I spent 7 terms doing this kind of stuff, with whether the weather coming from my stomach and going through my my dark L's, my short tongue, my stiff jaw, my thick neck, my rolling gait, and all the other. I mean, I left feeling like, it was going to be Kenneth Quasimodo Branagh entering the acting profession, you know.
Not exactly a confidence-building exercise, is it?
No, it isn't, but it makes you aware. It makes you aware of certain limitations that you might put on yourself if you're not careful.
Well, do you think all that weather stuff is part of the reason why you have such command over your voice, which I really think you do?
Well, it certainly has made one aware of, clarity. As an adolescent, partly because of what we were talking about earlier, I think partly because of not feeling one quite belonged where I was living, having come from Belfast and a large, extended, working-class family with lots of aunts and uncles and cousins and things, the sense of knowing exactly where one belonged was very strong. And when I was displaced from that particular environment, which many people are in all sorts of different ways all over the world, you often feel at a loss. And one of the things I think it does in adolescence particularly is it you attempt to hide by mumbling. So I spent a lot of my adolescence kind of talking like that, so that when people ask me things, I just say things like that, so that somehow I wouldn't be noticed. So drama school, in a sense, was a chance to re-educate myself and feeling and building that little more confidence, and then being given technical means by which one could express oneself more clearly and actually enjoy doing it. And then as one began to work on Shakespeare and some other classical texts, not only did you have some means by which you could express yourself clearly and technical equipment with which to do it, but you also had rather marvellous words which needed just that, because you can't mumble your way through a Shakespeare speech. You can't, without sufficient breath, do a big chunk of whatever, I don't know, Once More Unto the Breach or any of those things, or indeed convey any of the long, rather complicated thoughts that are sometimes in those plays without the technical equipment. But it was a drama school was a sort of rather an awakening through those technical means of a certain part of my personality, which I think had been rather damped down by being displaced from the environment that I felt most comfortable in.
So you think a lot of the coaching that you got and a lot of the vocal coaching that you got carried over into your personality as well as in the roles that you played?
I think so. I mean, it gave one a little more confidence in those basic communicative skills, you know, the fact that, one was encouraged to speak up and to speak clearly and to speak well and to speak articulately. And once you had those, of course, it was rather comforting, because once you find the words, and this is something I think that goes through my work, in fact. One of the reasons I'm interested in doing Shakespeare and trying to allow it to be seen by as many people as possible is that it, for me, it gives me the words and the stories and the emotions, if you like, that are rather helpful expressions in the world at this time, because so much of our language has reduced itself, so much of our reactions to things, to pieces of art or to pieces of popular culture or whatever, are reduced to rather arbitrary superlatives. Everything's, oh, it was wonderful, I thought it was wonderful, I thought it was wonderful, oh, it was terrible, it was terrible. And beyond that, we get stuck.
Kenneth Branagh, it was a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Kenneth Branagh recorded in 1991. He's now starring in a film adaptation of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, which he also directed. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel from All Things Considered. On today's program, we'll be hearing about President Clinton's speech at the Vietnam Memorial to a crowd of Vietnam veterans. Many applauded, but there were also many who jeered the president because of his avoidance of the draft during the Vietnam War. Also today, we'll have a story about two towns in Wisconsin who were caught up in a dispute over a distribution and storage center for Target discount drugs. It's part of a state effort to promote development, but many see it as a threat to the character of the community and the peace and tranquility that its residents savor. Also today, news of the 400th anniversary of the death of Elizabethan playwright Christopher Marlowe. Those stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Alto saxophonist Lee Konitz played on what's usually considered to be the first free jazz recordings with pianist Lenny Tristano in May of 1949. That same year, he'd already played on two of Miles Davis's highly influential Birth of the Cool sessions. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead, a self-confessed Konitz fan, says the saxophonist has barely slowed down since, recording with everyone from bandleader Stan Kenton to free jazz pianist Paul Bley. Kevin surveys some recent Konitz recordings.
There are a couple of reasons Lee Konitz is one of the great living jazz musicians. And the first of them is his characteristic soft and plump sound, as if his alto sax were stuffed with cotton. The other thing that makes Lee Konitz great is his willingness to abandon that distinctive sound if the situation demands it. In jazz, individualism is a tricky issue. It's a drag when younger musicians make records on which they play in the style of one master after another to show they've grasped the mechanics of their sound. Until recently, anyway, jazz has never been about that sort of faceless competence. It's about having something of your own to say. If improvising with other musicians is like having a conversation, then different settings may call for a different tone of voice. Three recent Konitz records, very different from one another, show how resourceful he can be. The first is a reissue called Chet Baker and Lee Konitz in Concert on the India Navigation label. Although Konitz and trumpeter Baker were associated with cool jazz in the 50s, when both played with Jerry Mulligan, this was their first real collaboration. It was taped at saxophonist Ornette Coleman's place in 1974. Baker and Konitz front a quartet without piano, as had Mulligan and Coleman, but the rambling feel is closer to Ornette's free bop than Mulligan's cool jazz. It's as if playing with Coleman in the room made Konitz alter his style as a sign of respect, sort of like watching your language in front of a priest. The 1990 recording, Zounds, on Soul Note, is the source for that solo introduction we heard at the top of this review. It's for quartet, with pianist Kenny Werner sometimes faking string parts on keyboard. With that gauzy backdrop behind him, Konitz makes his tone a little more harsh and piercing for contrast. This is from one of the three totally improvised pieces on Zounds. Konitz may be thinking of Ornette Coleman here, too. Lee Konitz is also on the new CD, Paul Motion on Broadway, Volume 3, a collection of standards, not all of them from Broadway, by drummer Motion and his longtime trio mates, guitarist Bill Frisell and tenor saxophonist Joe Lovano. Charlie Hayden plays bass on a few tracks, too. Konitz had never played with either Frisell or Lovano until a few days before this recording, when he sat in with Motion in a New York club. He instantly found a place for himself in the music, although the trio has a very slippery approach. This is from Harry Warren's I Wish I Knew. Faced with a new situation, jazz musicians do one of two things. They fall back on what they've practiced, or they improvise. Lee Konitz is a hardcore improviser. That's why he works in such varied contexts, and why he's worth hearing whenever you get the chance.
Kevin Whitehead is a critic and record annotator living in New York. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I hope you enjoy the rest of your holiday. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Evan Handler is best known as a New York actor who's starred in Broadway productions of Neil Simon plays and I Hate Hamlet. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Handler about writing and performing in a one-man show about his own experiences surviving leukemia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.